So I'd like to turn it over now to Dr. Carrie Emanuel, who will be leading us on this journey. There we go.
Well, thank you, Casey, and it's nice to be with you all. I assume that if you have questions, you might be able to interrupt me, assuming I can hear the questions. I've been asked to talk to you today about the response of hurricanes to global warming. It's a subject that I have worked on for about 22 years, actually. And it's of interest to us for a variety of reasons, which I'll get to. But the main backdrop is that hurricanes are currently worldwide the major dominant source of insured losses from natural hazards. I don't think I need to tell anybody who's on the line right now about what they mean to the United States after Hurricane Katrina. So naturally, we're interested in how hurricanes might respond to global warming. Could I have the next slide, please? I want to say this about hurricanes and global warming, that it's almost always posed as an issue of if the climate changes, how will hurricane activity change? That's an important issue, and it's the one I'm going to talk about today. But I want you all to be aware that there's another issue which gets less attention, and that is that if tropical cyclones, which, by the way, is the generic term for what we call hurricanes in the U.S., change in the climate, this may have an important feedback on the climate system itself. And that is another reason to want to know how they work, because if you want to predict climate and if hurricanes have an important effect back on climate, you need to be able to predict hurricanes well. I won't talk more about that today, but you should all be aware that that's an issue as well. Could we go to the next slide, please? So there are three approaches to the problem of how global warming might affect hurricanes. One is to look at the historical record to see if there are climate-related signals in that. A second method is to use our understanding of the physics of hurricanes directly to relate their activity to climate. And a third approach, which is closely related to the second, is to use models, numerical models or computer models, to try to help us understand the problem. Next slide, please. Let's start with something that's deceptively simple. This graph here shows the annual number of tropical cyclones all around the planet, going from 1970 to 2006. So, for example, there were something like 105 events in the year 1970. A couple of things to point out is that the average number of storms around the world is about 90. There's no indication of any long-term trend in that number. And of those 90, on average, 12 occur in the Atlantic. Now, this is something that surprises a lot of Americans because we tend to be a kind of parochial, is that most of the tropical cyclones that occur on our planet occur in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. The Atlantic storms are a minority, but they get 99% of the press. So it's not correct to think of hurricanes as an Atlantic phenomenon. This number 90 is not a number that science understands. We don't know why there are about 90 tropical cyclones on our planet as opposed to some completely different number. The reason this graph starts in 1970, by the way, is it's the first year that we deemed that we had global coverage by satellites. Before that, no doubt we missed some storms. Okay, can we go on to the next slide, please? So my field has developed better metrics of tropical cyclones, which are measuring their power or energy. And I'm going to discuss a particular index called the Power Dissipation Index, or PDI. It's literally defined as the sum over the lifetime of the storm of its maximum wind speed cubed, and can be shown to be a measure of the total amount of energy generated by the hurricane over its life. You could put that, if you were so inclined, in the units of megatons of dynamite, the way they rate the power of bombs. It's the same kind of metric, and it's somewhat more meaningful. We like to count, but nobody would dream of counting earthquakes because you wouldn't know which to put in a bin. There are micro tremors going on underneath us all the time. Do we put those in the same bin as a magnitude 9 earthquake? seismologists would never do that. We have to stop doing that as meteorologists. And that bin of 90 tropical cyclones per year are Katrinas and storms nobody notices that last 12 hours and where the wind only blows about 40 miles per hour that release many orders of magnitude less energy. So with that in mind, if we go to the next slide, let's look at how power dissipation has changed in time. So here is an estimate, a rather brave one, of power dissipation by Atlantic hurricanes going all the way back to 1870. So this is 1870 through 2006. With the provision that we don't really believe this data prior to about 1958. The reason that we don't believe it is that we didn't really have direct measurements of wind speeds in hurricanes until the late 1950s. There are a lot of reasons for that, but it shows you the drawback of using this metric is you actually need good measurements of hurricanes. And so you'll look at this record and you notice that there are fluctuations on timescales of 5 to 10 years, which we believe are associated with El Nino events in the Pacific. Activity on a longer time scale sort of started to climb in the early part of the 20th century and reached a peak around 1950 and then went down rather dramatically into the 70s and 80s and since about 1990 has been climbing quite rapidly. As a matter of fact, it's the power dissipation by Atlantic hurricanes has increased about threefold since 1990. So we go to the next slide, please. So this is the same graph. The blue that you see is the same as what we just looked at before. The green is a completely different quantity. It's the surface temperature of the tropical North Atlantic during hurricane season, August through October. This, in contrast to the hurricanes, is a pretty robust measurement going all the way back to the late 19th century. We actually believe the green curve pretty well. And you can see that there is a fantastic correlation between these curves, particularly in the modern period since 1958, when there's a very, very good correlation between ocean temperature and hurricane power. But even in the earlier part of the record, there is some indication of a correlation between these two quantities. The big anomaly is 1939 to 1945, where there was anomalously low hurricane power relative to what one would have expected based on the ocean temperature. And that, we believe, is an artifact of World War II, when the ships, which during that time we relied on to transmit information about hurricanes, were forbidden from making radio transmissions. So there is this connection between the power and ocean temperature. Now, the power of hurricanes is not only of interest to meteorologists, but of interest to society, because the destruction that hurricanes do when they make landfall is closely related to their power. The number of hurricanes does not matter. It's something that one hears a lot about in seasonal forecasts, which I wish they'd stop doing, because they're misleading, to first order. We Americans do not or should not care about Category 1 and 2 hurricanes, which make up the vast majority of hurricanes. The destructive ones are the minority players, the 3, 4s, and 5s. The 3, 4s, and 5s contribute disproportionately also to this power dissipation index. So power dissipation is much more meaningful than counts and much better correlated to environmental predictors like temperature. Now, we'll see later why we have good reason to believe on theoretical grounds that hurricane power ought to be correlated with temperature, but for now, let's just notice that it is. And could we go to the next slide, please? So the next question you might ask is, since there's been this very large variation of hurricane power over the 20th century and going on into our own century, and since it's correlated with ocean temperature, why did the ocean temperature do what? We've seen that hurricane power in the Atlantic is very quite a bit over the last century. In the last 2.5 decades, it's gone up by a factor of 3, and that it seems to vary coincidentally with the temperature of the tropical ocean in hurricane season. And the graph you're looking at now compares the temperature of the tropical ocean, tropical Atlantic, in hurricane season to the whole northern hemispheric temperature, just to demonstrate that they're pretty much the same. They vary the same way. And if we could go to the next slide now, please. So the black curve at the top of this graph shows the temperature of the entire planet going back to 1900 relative to its value in 1900. And we'd like to know what causes these variations in North Atlantic temperature that have led to the variations in hurricane power. And we'd like to know, therefore, what caused the Northern Hemispheric temperature to change. Now, this is showing a slightly different quantity, the global temperature, but we'll start there because, in fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change spent a lot of time trying to figure out why the temperature of the planet varied the way it did over the 20th century. So the black curve shows that temperature. You can see it increased in the early part of the 20th century, leveled off between about 1950 and 1975, and it's been increasing since then. The brown line that's kind of behind that black line, inside an envelope of gray, shows attempts to replicate that record using a suite of global climate models, which is another tool used to predict and understand climate. And the gray envelope gives you an appreciation of the variability from one model to the other and from, in fact, different states of the model. And to some degree, the models do a reasonable job capturing what happened in the 20th century. To be sure, there are variations. But at least with the models, we can unravel exactly why the temperature changed the way it did. And that's what's shown by all the squiggly color lines at the bottom of this graph. And there are five curves, but I'll only talk about four of them. There are four big sources of the changes in temperature of the planet over the 20th century, two of which are completely natural. The red curve shows varying sunlight. The sun isn't absolutely constant. And the green curve shows the effect of volcanic eruptions, which actually cool the planet by putting reflectors into the stratosphere. Then there are two man-made effects. One is a cooling effect. This is tropospheric air pollution in the form of sulfate aerosols. That's given by the purple curve, which is largely in negative territory here. And then, of course, the greenhouse gases in blue. And so the answer to why the climate varied over the 20th century is a complex one. It's not something you can put on a bumper sticker. There were four sources of variability, and one of the reasons the temperature increased in the beginning of the 20th century was, first of all, increasing sunlight, and secondly, a kind of a statistical accident of an absence of major volcanic eruptions between 1918 and 1961. There just weren't any big ones, and that did allow the climate to warm up. Then the cooling, or the leveling off in the mid to late part of the century, was mostly driven by man-made sulfite aerosol pollution, sometimes called global dimming. And the warming that we've seen in the last 20 to 30 years has largely been driven by greenhouse gases. So could we go to the next slide? And so let's now come from the globe back to the northern hemisphere and indeed back to the tropical Atlantic. And this red curve once again shows the global mean surface temperature, in this case going back to about 1870. And the blue curve shows the temperature of the tropical Atlantic. And you'll notice that they do pretty much the same thing up until the middle part of the 20th century. And then the northern hemisphere, or I should say the tropical Atlantic, cools relative to the globe. And so, in fact, and the tropical Atlantic aren't doing exactly the same thing, and Mike Mann and I wondered why that was so. But it turns out of those four forcing agents I just discussed, one of them, and only one of them, is peculiar to the northern hemisphere, and that's the man-made sulfate aerosols. They're produced by biomass burning and especially by fossil fuel combustion. Most of that is in the northern hemisphere. Indeed, that is where most of the sulfate aerosols are. That aqua curve you see, which starts at zero and then goes down, is the radiative forcing by sulfate aerosols. And we think that's mostly in the northern hemisphere. So we asked a relatively simple question. Can you account for the difference between the two hemispheres by that sulfate aerosol curve? So what we're going to do is take that aqua blue line and add it to the red line. And if we can go on to the next graph, that this red line now shows the result of that addition and compares it to the tropical Atlantic sea surface temperature. And it fits pretty well. And that tells us that, in some sense, the simplest explanation for why the tropical Atlantic temperature varied the way it did over the 20th century is not so simple. Again, the rise from about 1920 to 1940 or 1950 was mostly owing to changing sunlight and the absence of volcanoes in that period. The cooling from 1950 to 1980 seems to have largely been driven by man-made sulfate aerosols, and the warming since then is largely greenhouse gases. So that is our best shot at what happened in the 20th century. Now, none of those things that I just talked about is periodic. It's not cyclical. And there are various people who look at this graph you have before you and say, aha, there are multi-decadal cycles in Atlantic hurricanes. Well, we don't think there's anything cyclic about it, and no good mathematician would ever look at a time series that has one maximum and two minima and say, oh, there's a cycle there. So I would like to caution you against looking at a graph like that and concluding that there's a cyclic phenomenon. We don't think there is. Next graph, please. Let's talk very quickly about the physics. Next one. A hurricane is actually understood. The physics of hurricanes are understood pretty well. A hurricane can be conceived of a heat engine, which converts the heat energy from the ocean into wind energy. And so the main source of energy in a hurricane is the evaporation of ocean water. You all have the experience of feeling cold when you get out of a lake or a shower because you're wet and water is evaporating from your skin, taking heat from your body. Well, that energy does not disappear. Energy is conserved. It gets added to the air. Exactly the same thing happens in a hurricane. Heat energy is taken out of the ocean and put into the atmosphere. And the ocean slightly cools when that happens, and that heat energy is added to the atmosphere. And this happens very efficiently in a hurricane. And we understand the physics quite well, so well that we can actually come up with a formula for predicting the peak winds in a hurricane that are theoretically possible in a given climate. And if we could go to the next graph, next slide, this shows a map of the annual maximum theoretical upper bound on hurricane wind speed from this energy argument. And I'm sorry about the units here. The units are in meters per second. You may not be familiar with that. If you multiply by 2, very nearly, you're going to get miles per hour. Actually, it's a little bit more than 2. And so in the equatorial regions, you can have hurricanes. Actually, it works out to be about 200 miles per hour, which is, in fact, close to the very largest or strongest winds that were measured in hurricanes. And that theoretical maximum drops off very quickly as you go to higher latitudes and is effectively zero in the polar oceans. Next slide, please. This theoretical bound, which we call the potential intensity, is not steady. It varies with climate. And this graph shows you an example of it. It's the upper bound on hurricane wind speed for the North Atlantic from 1950 to about 2006. And again, the unit is meters per second, so if you multiply by a little bit more than 2, you'll get miles per hour. But the main point of this graph is to show that there was a decline in potential intensity from about 1950 to about 1980 or so, and then a rapid rise beginning in about 1990. So that since 1990, this upper bound on hurricane wind speeds has increased by about 10% in the Atlantic. And this is why we think that real hurricane power has also gone up during that period. Okay, next slide, please. People often make statements which are completely unjustified to the extent that Hurricane Katrina was caused by global warming. Unfortunately, Al Gore kind of does this sometimes. Well, we can't say that. These are random, chaotic events, and to attribute any event to any cause at all, whether it's global warming or something else, is simply not possible. Nevertheless, we can do some interesting experiments to ask, for example, with respect to a particular storm like Hurricane Katrina, if that exact same storm had occurred, let's say, in the year 1980, what would it have been like? And that's what we try to answer with some computer simulations of Hurricane Katrina. So what you see before you here is a graph showing, as a function of time from August through September of 2005, the measured peak wind speed in Hurricane Katrina in nautical miles per hour, or knots, and that's given by the blue curve. So on the 24th of August, Hurricane Katrina was just forming. It reached its peak as a Cat 5 storm with about 150 knot winds late on the 28th of August and started to decline. It made landfall late on the 29th. The red curve on this graph is an attempt to simulate the evolution of Katrina's winds with a computer model, given the thermodynamic environment that was actually observed in the year 2005, that is the sea surface temperature of the Gulf of Mexico, the atmospheric temperature, and so on. And it's a, as these things go, relatively good simulation. It actually shows that the hurricane made landfall with a peak wind of about 130 knots. The observations are considerably less than that, but I think a lot of the people who've looked at the observations think they're wrong. Observations are not by any means perfect, even in the Atlantic. And I'm sure that the folks at the National Hurricane Center who are reanalyzing Katrina will actually end up increasing their assessment of its intensity at landfall. Now, the final curve, the green curve, is another computer simulation, but done with the thermodynamic environment of 1980, which was considerably cooler than 2005. And you can see that Katrina only makes it up to a sort of upper category 3 hurricane at its peak, and makes landfall not at 138 knots, but at something like 115 or 117 knots, which might not sound like a lot of difference, but it makes a huge difference in destructive power. Probably, if Katrina had occurred in 1980, the levees would have held. So global warming didn't cause Katrina, but it did cause Katrina to be more intense than it otherwise would have been. Next slide, please. Now, how do we make projections going into the future? And the main tool to do that is the same climate models that I talked about before. But if I could go to the next slide, there's a problem with using climate models to do this, and that is simply that they are too coarse, they're not powerful enough, if you will, to simulate tropical cyclones. There are computational nodes at which the actual computations are carried out are around 100 miles apart, and the inner core of a hurricane is 20 or 30 miles across. You simply can't resolve a hurricane with a climate model. So what do you do? Next slide. Well, there are various different solutions to this, and we've developed one here at MIT, which we're quite fond of, which is an exercise called downscaling, which is inferring the characteristics of a fine-scale phenomenon using the coarse-grained knowledge or predictions that you get from climate models. And the approach can be conceptualized as consisting of four steps. The first is to take the climate state that is simulated and seed it randomly with sort of very weak proto-hurricanes. So you sort of imagine going down to your local greenhouse and buying a packet of hurricane seeds and throwing them randomly over the globe as a first step. Now, those seeds, the first thing to do is keep track of where they go. That turns out to be fairly simple because hurricanes simply move with a large-scale atmospheric flow in which they're embedded. And the climate models are predicting exactly what that atmospheric flow is. So once those seeds are thrown down, it's very easy to keep track of where they go. The third and crucial step is that we now run a very specialized coupled ocean atmosphere model of a hurricane, computer model, for each of those seeds to find out whether it intensifies or loses steam or whatever. And point of fact, about 98% of those seeds are just predicted to die, which, by the way, is about the same rate of success I have in my real garden at home. Most of them die. And the few that survive are considered to constitute the climatology of hurricanes in that model. We continue to follow their track and intensity using these models. So it's a kind of a natural selection technique. We put lots and lots of proto-hurricanes down. Most of them die. The survivors are regarded as constituting the hurricane climatology for that state. Next slide, please. So here is, in point of fact, we actually can put down tens or even hundreds of thousands of these tracks. This is just showing a random sample of 200 tracks that make landfall in the United States in this data set. It's color-coded according to the Saffir-Simpson scale, so where you see red is Category 5, blue is Category 1, and so on. And they behave like real hurricanes, and we subject this to lots and lots of statistical tests to reassure us that these storms are doing pretty much what real hurricanes do. But instead of having a problematic historical database of a few hundred storms, we can make an actual database of 100,000 storms very easily and therefore do much more robust statistics. Next slide, please. We do have to do a one-time calibration of the technique, which is just the rate at which you throw down the seeds. We do that to get the North Atlantic, the frequency of events in the North Atlantic correct over the period 1980 to 2005. Next slide, please. And this shows that aside from the Atlantic, where we've calibrated it to be correct, that in other parts of the world oceans, the eastern North Pacific, western North Pacific, and so on, with the exception of the eastern North Pacific, we get about the right rate of storm formation. Very good, for example, in the western North Pacific. Blue is observed, red is what's predicted by this natural selection technique. Once again, it's been calibrated for the Atlantic, so that agreement is forced, but the other parts of the world oceans are free. Next slide, please. And we get, I'm going to go through these kind of quickly because they're just a lot of statistics to reassure us that we do all right. This simply shows the number of storms per month in the Atlantic. Blue is observed, red is predicted. We had better, the technique better, for example, predict that we have more storms in summer than in winter. Otherwise, there must be something wrong with it. And it does quite well on the number of storms per month. Next slide, please. And this slide shows the number of events per millennium whose lifetime maximum wind speed exceeds the value you see on the bottom axis. Blue is observed from about 550 events. Red is predicted, in this case using a small data set of only about 3,000 events. And you can see that the two curves look similar. We get about the right statistical distribution of storm intensity. Next slide, please. And we even capture the effect of El Nino and other climate, natural climate phenomena on the Atlantic. So this compares in observed in blue to predicted in red number of events in the Atlantic by different of natural climate signals like El Nino and another thing you probably haven't heard of called the Atlantic Meridional Mode or AMM. Next slide, please. This simply shows that over the world's oceans, by this technique, the percentage of Category 4 and 5 storms has been increasing between 1980 and the present. Next slide. So now that we have developed this technique, let's actually apply it to future climates as predicted by the suite of global climate models that were used by the IPCC in their latest projections. Next slide, please. And we're going to compare two sets of simulations for each of seven global climate models. This is, again, applying our hurricane downscaling to these models. The first set of simulations is for the last 20 years of the 20th century. You might consider that to be the current climate. And the next set of predictions, the next set of downscaling would be applied to the years 2180 to 2200 under a particular IPCC emission scenario called A1B, in which carbon dioxide continues to increase until it's about 720 parts per million, or about double today's value. Next slide, please. and this is kind of a bottom line, it shows the percentage change in hurricane power in each of five parts of the world's oceans, going from left to right, the Atlantic, Eastern North Pacific, Western North Pacific, the North Indian Ocean, and all of the Southern Hemisphere lumped together. And the different colors are the results from different climate models. And what you see on this graph is unfortunately typical of what happens when you start looking at climate models regionally. There's a big difference from one place to the next. So you can see that there's a wide variety of results. In the Western Pacific, however, most of the models agree that there will be a substantial increase in hurricane power. But in the Southern Hemisphere, there's a pretty good consensus that there'll be a decrease over the next 200 years. The Atlantic is kind of all over the place. Of the seven models, five produce increases and two produce decreases. The majority is for fairly increased activity. Next slide, please. This is the seven model consensus and the change in regions of storm formation. So where you see red, more storms would be forming per unit time, and where you see blues, you'd have fewer. So in the Atlantic, what you have is a northward shift from the Caribbean into the more central Atlantic in storm formation. You have a general decline in the eastern North Pacific and through most of the Southern Hemisphere. An eastward shift in the western tropical Pacific, and a decrease in the Bay of Bengal, but an increase in the Arabian Sea. Next slide, please. Now, you can start to, of course, you can filter these storms to look at only those that, for example, make landfall in the United States. And you can calculate something called a damage potential, which is a function of wind speed at landfall. Damage goes up very quickly with wind speed. And this shows for four different climate models, going from left to right. You won't understand necessarily the acronyms, but they're just four different climate models. And these are, again, downscaling those climate models to get the hurricane activity. The predicted coastal destructive potential, if you will, for the present climate in blue and for the future climate in red. And you can see that all four models are predicting increases in coastal damage. Even some models like the ECHAM model, which produced decreased Atlantic storm activity, actually produced increased destruction, or destructive potential, I should say, in the U.S. In the case of the rightmost model, the GFDL, the increase is more than a factor of two over 200 years. But in the case of the leftmost model, it's only by about 20 or 30%. So there's a lot of variation from one. This is now specializing to the northeastern United States, which is defined from New York City to Eastport, Maine. And here we're looking at seven climate models plus a data set that essentially represents a combination over all seven. And only one of the seven actually produces a decrease of activity in the Northeast. And some, like the MIROC, which is a Japanese model, produce a rather huge change in potential damage in the Northeast, so also for the GFDL model. The northward shift in storm formation predicted across these models really does hurt the northeastern U.S. Next slide, please. So let me bring this to a conclusion so I can get to your questions. In summary, the tropical cyclones are demonstrably sensitive to climate state, and this is revealed by historical and geological data. I didn't have time to show you the geological data today, but that's really interesting. Observations suggest that tropical cyclone power goes up quite rapidly with this quantity called potential intensity, which in turn rises with sea surface temperature. Next slide, please. We have this new technique for downscaling climate models, and this shows a lot of promise for predicting how tropical cyclones will respond to climate change. But the climate models themselves aren't there yet. They probably have systematic errors that compromise these estimates of tropical cyclone response to global warming and cause there to be large differences from one model to the next. So that concludes my presentation, and I'll turn it back over to you, Casey, and of course I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Emanuel.